reply is to the figure that is standing in between the children of Horus. And he is, how old is he? 4,000-year-old person called Setne Kumayast. Is the son of the...
Describes the fellow's name.
Yes, S-E-T-N-E.
S-E-T.
N-E. And Kumayast is K-H-A-M-U-A-S-T. Kumayast. K-H-A-M-U-A-S-T. Who's the high priest of Memphis? This is Memphis, Egypt, as opposed to Memphis, Tennessee, where he would have quite a different kind of role in Memphis, Tennessee. But this is Memphis, Egypt. He's the first known Egyptologist in the world, because he's living at a time but 1,000 years after the Pyramid Age. And one of the things that he does is to dig out the pyramids, which have been covered over by the sands of the desert. So it's a bit of an extraordinary thought, really, when you think of somebody 4,000 years ago looking back 1,000 years, trying to understand the things they did 1,000 years ago. You know, it's, in our terms, it's a bit like going back to the 11th century and trying to understand things. There's something about just the vast scope of Egyptian civilization. Now, Setne is also known as a great magician. And there's a great story about him where he goes to find this mythical scroll called the Book of Thoth. Now, Thoth is one of the great gods of magic in Egyptian tradition. But he's interesting because he is the scribe. The scribe of the gods, the one who writes. And scribes in ancient Egypt were these kind of magical figures because they put the image on paper or on stone, or wherever they put the image, so that the image could live and have independent life of the person experiencing the image. Now, writing, you know, again, we're used to writing. We're used to, you know, you're writing now, and it's second nature to us all in all the various ways we do it. But writing is this profoundly magical act, because what it means is the internal image of internal aspects of a human experience can be transcribed into something and can have independent life of the owner. So we read the experience of somebody else and it comes to life within us. And if you write a poem or a song or something, you actually discover that when you've finished it, it has its own life. It no longer feels part of you. And it has its own trajectory then in the world. It travels, having effect, creating new possibilities. And you can come across your own writings later on sometimes and discover that there are things in it, or things in the writings you had no idea were there. So, you know, it's like some other being. The writing is its own being and talks back to you and shows you things that you were unaware of. So for the Egyptians, this idea of being a scribe was this extraordinarily magical kind of act. And the god Thoth was a lunar god, a moon god, you know, and was a great teacher of the scribes. And so they had this idea of that somewhere there was this magical scroll that could contain all the secrets of creating images, creating kind of letters, creating that would hold somewhere the secrets of creation itself. And I mean, the story of Setne is quite interesting because he's in quite a similar position to us, because he's trying to recover things that were known about but are now got forgotten. So when we look at these old stories, old things, we're for ourselves trying to make sense of ideas and approaches from a much from an older civilization, and things that have been forgotten. So rather oddly, we sit in the same position as Setni, looking into these things, trying to make out what is really about. And the time that he's doing it is quite an interesting time as well, because in the 19th dynasty is just after the time of the pharaoh Akhenaten, Akhenaten is known as the heretic pharaoh because he demolished the religion of the old religion of Egypt completely, invented his own religion called the religion of the Aten, closed all the temples of Egypt, and this is a society that had been stable for over 1,000 years. So he sort of completely shut down the whole kind of Egyptian, effectively shut down the Egyptian religious culture, declared that he was the son of the sun and the living god, and bankrupted the country by building a huge new city in a place called Amarna, it caused a total collapse with famine and poverty in Egypt as a result of this. And sort of out of the... So Egypt as a society, therefore, completely fell apart in a way that we can't understand, because where we're used to societies moving. Egyptian society had not changed for about 1,000 years. It was very, very stable, partly because of its climatic conditions and the Nile Valley is incredibly fertile. So it had created this very stable thing, which is then blown apart by one man's vision. And also the centralization of power that was there in the kingship. So we get at the time that Setne is around and working, Egyptian society is trying to recover itself from this huge kind of cataclysm that happened to it over a period of about 20 or 30 years. And they're trying to rediscover. So there's this huge blast of creativity that starts to happen. And and it's actually the time where the great pharaoh Ramses II arises. He becomes one of the greatest of all the pharaohs. So actually, and Setna is one of his sons. But so this whole movement in Egypt is about a society trying to recover contact with its old images, but reinterpreting those images in a much more internal kind of way. And in a way, we're in a similar position, really, when we look at working with archetypes, working with images, we're treating the living image seriously and embodying the image. We're trying to learn how to do that, because in our world, particularly since the 18th century, that whole aspect of the human imagination has become very, very externalized. And which is why, the most powerful example of human imagination these days is in the use of advertising and the use of images in advertising to sell things to people. You know, so what we're trying to do here is to reclaim the innerness of the image and the democracy of the image as well, that every person has a profound, you know, because imagination in a way has also been relegated to people who can create elite goods that can be bought for high value. So the idea that all human beings are innately creative is something that is paid lip service to, but not really. Because actually vision, if taken seriously, transforms everything, transforms political systems, transforms military systems. And you know, we're allowed to play with imagination around the periphery of the society, but not in any place that challenges the entrenched power structures of our society. So in a sense, we're trying to do really what Setne was trying to do. And so what he decides he needs to do is to find the mythical Book of Thoth. And we find him researching in the archives of Memphis, and he hears the story. And I'll read a bit from the Papyrus of Setni. This is quite nice imagery, really. So he reads about a figure in the sort of in the Old Kingdom, again about 900 years before him, called Nenefer-ka-Ptah. Now Ptah is the god of, is the, in Egyptian, is the creator god who creates through the mouth. He speaks the magical words. He's also seen as being, the god of craftspeople, of everybody who can create things. So Nenefer-ka-Ptah would mean the one who has the one who connect, whose soul is beautiful and connected to the god Ptah. And Nenefer-ka-Ptah is said to have possessed the Book of Thoth. So he is this sort of ancient figure. I mean, you know, in a sense, we're doing a parallel thing. So we're saying, well, here's Setne, who possessed the Book of Thoth. He's saying, beyond me, there is Nenefer-ka-Ptah, who possesses the Book of Thoth. And what he does is the little meditation, little image sequence we did just before lunch, is a condensed version of the journey that Kamayast did, because he goes upstream, he goes to a tomb, he finds in the tomb a scroll. But his story, it's the finding of the Book of Thoth is kind of laborious, because he has a lot of challenges. It's kind of beautiful. This is quite a beautiful image for this. Let me just find it. So the Book of Thoth is found in the tomb, but it's in the middle of a sea, in a box of iron, which is in itself, which is a box of iron, which contains within it a box of bronze, which contains within it a box of acacia wood. Inside that there is a box of ivory and ebony. Inside the box of ivory and ebony is a box of silver. In the box of silver there is a box of gold. Surrounding the box of gold, there is every kind of serpent and scorpion and reptile. And wrapped around it is the endless snake. Now this is a sort of image, really, of moving through layers of an image. So the box of iron will be the outer form, the box of bronze, something a bit more inner, the box of acacia wood. And acacia wood in Egypt meant had a connection to the god Osiris. So you're getting. It's almost like an alchemical process where you're getting from the outer image more and more and more in towards the inner image. And right as you get to the place where the book, in the golden box, you come across all these obstacles. So as you get near the central point, there's all these serpents, there's snakes, there's scorpions. And there's the endless snake that twists round and round. Now, of course, this is an this is a set of images which describes the obstacles that we encounter in this meditation. These are the things that push us away, that frighten us, that stop us. And in particular, the thing to watch for is the endless snake, because the endless snake is the place where the thoughts loop around in a circle. And we have to get past that. So that's the place where our thinking, our patterns just fold. And that particular pattern of I'm doing it wrong, which is like it's an endless loop. So most of our obstacles in this work take us into the place. So there's a freeze thing that happens. Oh my God, here's this dangerous, terrible things. But then we get caught in the endless reiterating loop, which if we get past, we then... The final box opens, and we find ourselves with the scroll and there's something, you know, it's beautiful. He opens the book and he says he reads from it a formula of writing, and he enchanted heaven, earth, and the underworld. So the above ground, below ground, here we are. So there's something about as you find the book of thought, you connect all the layers of human experience. He saw the sun shining forth in heaven with his divine cycle. He saw the rising of the moon and the stars in their forms. He saw the fishes in the deep. So it opens, so in a sense, that any image, any experience brings us, if we pursue it, brings us into this place of being the magician in the center of the room, connecting the depth and the height and all around, and connected to everything. We become effectively the living tree, the Ished tree, that is in itself generative, that is in itself in relationship with everything. Now, it's just a great, it's just a great example, really, of kind of, and I won't go into the whole story. It's very complicated, and we don't really need it. But one of the key pieces to it, in the end, is that this experience causes the and there's a battle between Nanefika Tata and Kamarest, but actually they are repeating a story so that something gets transmitted. And as part of the experience of receiving the book of Thoth, in a way receiving the limited image, something gets lost. Things die. And in terms of the Ptah Nefekatah, he loses his wife and child die, and eventually he dies. So there's a sort of a loss of self involved in that experience. But in that experience, what happens is that that as Nefekatah dies, he also becomes at one with the Book of Thoth and becomes the rudder of the boat of the sun. He becomes the steersman of the boat of the sun. So in a sense, his old identity, his family identity, dies away. It's not a literal story. His family identity dies away. He dies away. But what he becomes is, he becomes at one with the kind of the magic and the power of this, of the Book of Thoth, and he then becomes one of those who help to steer the boat of the sun, which means that becomes one who helps to enable the balance of the world to be maintained and developed. And in a way that, it's a very dramatic, very ancient story, but in a way there's something quite literal about it. As you receive and work with these images, something in you falls away, something dies, and as you unite with that energy, your sense of self does die away, just as Becky was saying before lunch, and somewhere, but then you get connected to something that's about the rising energy of the universe, that is like the boat of the sun, like the fact that we need the sun to rise every day. You get connected to something bigger that's trying to express itself through you. And you become then the person who helps to guide that energy into existence. And in the story, he guides a sacred barge back to Memphis, back to the everyday world. So he becomes then this figure then who links between the worlds, who ferries between the imaginal world and the everyday world.
In a sense, that's almost like the Native American giveaway.
Yeah.
Once you receive the wisdom, then your task is to give that away.
Yeah, your task, you're at the service of that then, aren't you? So then it transmits it through you. But it does mean, in order for that to happen, the aspects of your sense of self have to fall away, because otherwise you're not a clear vessel or a clear channel for that to happen.
Hermes, it also reminds me of Hermes, like the god, the hermetic.
Yes, yeah.
The messenger.
Yes.
The unconscious.
Yes, that's right, and who mediates between those worlds. Yes, that's right, and Hermes is a and you've got this interesting figure from Egypt and Greece, where you've got a blend of a god called Hermanubis, who is a fusion of the god Anubis, who opens the way, and the Greek god Hermes. So now, one of the things you see, and Egypt has this enormous kind of effect on the ancient world. I mean, the Greeks go to Egypt and regard Egypt as the home of magic, and you get a lot of translation of these older Greek images, older Egyptian images, into Greek tradition. Very specifically, when you get during the period of Alexander, where Alexander brings Greek culture and Egyptian culture together, and you get this extraordinary city in the Mediterranean called Alexandria, that is one of the great great repositories of wisdom at that time. Just so I just want to do one short exercise. I'm going to have a break for a cup of tea. So